A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the satellite imagery from April. U Air Force C-17s parked on the tarmac at Ben Gurion Airport, right next to LAL-787s. A civilian international gateway doubling as a logistics hub during an active shooting war with Iran. And the question is, how do you actually run a dual-use airfield like that? What's shared, what's segregated, and what do you do about the obvious criticism that you're using civilian passengers as human shields? There's a lot to unpack here.
That image of a C-17 parked next to a 787 raises a question that goes beyond this one conflict. How do you run an airport that serves both tourists and troops? And the answer is, with enormous difficulty and a lot of very careful protocols that most people never see.
Welcome to my weird prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. So let's start with the basics. A dual-use airfield is any aerodrome certified for both civilian commercial traffic and military operations. That can range from full integration, shared runways, shared towers, shared everything, to what you see at Ben Gurion, which is segregated parallel operations on the same physical footprint.
Ben Gurion is Israel's primary international gateway. It's operated by the Israel Airports Authority, a civilian body. But it also has dedicated military aprons on the south side of the airfield, and there's a permanent Israeli Air Force presence there. It's not like the military just shows up during wars and borrows a parking spot.
Right, and that's an important distinction. The military infrastructure at Ben Gurion is baked in. It's not an ad hoc arrangement. During April 2026, during what the IDF called Operation Guardian of the Walls 2, U-Central Command used Ben Gurion as a logistics hub for resupply and medical evacuation. They specifically chose it over purely military airfields like Nevatim down in the Negev or Ramon down near Eilat.
Which seems counterintuitive. Why would you put your military cargo through the country's busiest civilian airport during a conflict?
Because the civilian airport is actually better. Ben Gurion's runway, 1230, is 3,112 meters long. Nevatim Air Base, which is one of Israel's premier military airfields, has a runway that's only 2,700 meters. That extra 400 meters matters enormously when you're landing a fully loaded C-17 carrying Patriot missile components or armored vehicles.
The civilian runway is literally more capable than the military one.
And it's not just length. Ben Gurion has Category 3B instrument landing systems on both runways, which means aircraft can land in near zero visibility. Military airfields often have less sophisticated weather instrumentation because combat aircraft train for all weather operations anyway, and they can divert. But when you're running a logistics air bridge during a conflict, you can't afford weather delays. You need that CAT-3B capability.
Capability drives the decision. But that still leaves the question of how you actually run two completely different types of operations on the same piece of concrete without things going catastrophically wrong.
To understand how Ben Gurion pulled this off, we need to look at the nuts and bolts of air traffic control, because that's where the real segregation happens.
I assume you have a diagram somewhere.
I have several. So Ben Gurion uses what's called a split ATC model. The civilian control tower, which is managed by the Israel Airports Authority, handles all commercial traffic on the main runways. That's runway 08/26 and runway 12/30. The military side has its own dedicated control tower that handles movements on the IAF apron and the military taxiways. But here's the critical piece. Both towers coordinate through a joint approach control center.
That's not physically at Ben Gurion, right?
No, it's at the Israeli Air Force's Unit 333, which is based at Tel Nof Air Base about 30 kilometers south. Unit 333 is the IAF's Central Air Traffic Control Unit. They handle all military approach control for the entire country. During normal operations, they coordinate with Ben Gurion's civilian approach control through established handoff procedures. During the April 2026 surge, they embedded a dedicated military liaison officer directly in the civilian tower at Ben-Gurion.
You literally have an IAF officer standing in the civilian control tower.
Sitting at a console, yes. And their entire job is to deconflict movements in real time. If a UC-17 is on final approach and an LL-737 is pushing back from the gate, the liaison officer coordinates directly with the civilian controller to sequence them safely. It's not two separate systems ignoring each other. It's two systems actively talking through a human bridge.
That bridge exists because the alternative is either complete segregation, which wastes the runway capacity, or complete integration, which is a security nightmare.
And the security dimension is where this gets really interesting. Ben-Gurion operates a three-ring security model. The outer ring is the civilian checkpoints, the vehicle screening at the airport entrance, the perimeter fence patrols. During the Iran conflict, that outer ring was reinforced with IDF KFIR brigade troops. These are infantry soldiers, not private security guards.
Which is a significant escalation from normal operations.
It's a wartime posture. The middle ring is terminal access. That's the Shin Bet and airport security personnel you see at the entrances to the terminal buildings. That remained unchanged during the conflict because it's already designed for a high-threat environment. The inner ring is the military apron itself, controlled exclusively by IAF security forces with zero civilian access. Not even the airport's own security personnel can enter that area without IAF authorization.
Here's the problem with that neat three-ring model. The shared airside, the area between the terminal and the runways.
That's exactly where the model breaks down. During the April operations, military cargo trucks had to transit within 200 meters of the civilian terminal building to get from the military apron to the runway access points. That's uncomfortably close. In March 2026, before the major operations began, the IAF installed blast barriers along that transit route.
They saw the vulnerability and tried to mitigate it.
But a blast barrier protects against secondary explosions and fragmentation. It doesn't change the fact that military cargo is moving through an area that, under normal interpretations of international humanitarian law, is supposed to be purely civilian.
Which brings us to the human shield accusation. Let's get into that.
The technical side works, but the legal and security implications are where things get messy. Let's talk about the human shield accusation and the OPSEC nightmare.
The criticism is pretty straightforward. Under additional protocol, I to the Geneva Conventions, using civilian infrastructure for military purposes can constitute a violation if it exposes civilians to attack. The argument goes, if you park military aircraft at Ben-Gurion, you've made the airport a legitimate military target, and the civilians in the terminal are now effectively human shields.
It's not just activists making this argument. There are serious legal scholars who've raised concerns. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been clear in its commentaries that the presence of military objectives within civilian infrastructure can transform the status of that infrastructure under IHL. The key test is proportionality and whether the military advantage gained outweighs the risk to civilians.
Israel's counter-argument has some weight too. The military operations are physically segregated to the South Apron. Civilian traffic continues during the day. The military presence is temporary. It's not a permanent basing arrangement. And there's a genuine military necessity argument. The longer runways and better instrumentation at Ben-Gurion means safer operations, which means fewer risks of accidents that could also harm civilians.
There's another layer. Israel argues that the alternative, concentrating all military airlift at exposed military bases in the Negev, would actually increase risk. Nevatim and Ramon were targeted by Iranian ballistic missiles during the conflict. Ben-Gurion, by contrast, has Iron Dome batteries co-located on the airfield perimeter. The military apron itself has hardened aircraft shelters. It's arguably the most defended piece of tarmac in the country.
The human shield argument assumes the civilian airport is more vulnerable, but the reality might be the opposite. The military is actually seeking the protection of the civilian airfield's defenses.
Which is its own legal problem, by the way. If you're placing military assets at a civilian airport specifically because the air defenses there are better, you're deliberately co-locating military objectives with civilian infrastructure. That's a much harder argument to defend under IHL than saying, we're just using the longer runway.
As of today, May 22nd, 2026, the ICRC hasn't issued a formal opinion on the April operations, which is interesting in itself.
The ICRC is reportedly drafting new guidance on dual-use infrastructure in urban warfare, expected late 2026. That could significantly reshape how countries like Israel, South Korea, and the UAE operate their dual-use airfields. But for now, we're in a legal gray zone. The operations happened, the critiques were made, and nobody with authority has definitively ruled either way.
Let's talk about the OPSEC side, because there was an incident in April that really illustrates the risks of running military ops through a civilian airport.
This one is going to be studied in military academies for years. Air Force C-17 departing Ben-Gurion mistakenly broadcast its mission identifier on civilian frequencies. Within 12 minutes, open-source intelligence trackers on Twitter and various Discord servers had identified the cargo as Patriot missile system components.
How does that even happen?
Military aircraft use what are called squawk codes, transponder codes that air traffic control uses to identify them on radar. Military flights often squawk civilian-style codes when operating in civilian airspace to blend in with commercial traffic. The problem is, if you're using a civilian transponder code, your flight data shows up on Flight Radar 24 and ADS-B Exchange, just like any other aircraft. And if your mission identifier, which is a separate data field, gets broadcast along with your position, altitude, and call sign, anyone with a $10 ADS-B receiver can see it.
These open-source intelligence communities are remarkably sophisticated.
They're incredible. They cross-reference flight paths with known military bases, they track patterns of movement, they identify aircraft by their registration numbers and maintenance histories. In this case, the mission identifier contained a cargo code that corresponded to Patriot system components in a publicly available U-Military Logistics database. The C-17 crew probably didn't even realize the identifier was being broadcast.
The civilian infrastructure didn't just create a legal vulnerability. It created an intelligence vulnerability that a purely military airfield wouldn't have.
At Nevatim or Ramon, the approach control is entirely military. There's no civilian ADS-B coverage because civilian receivers are jammed or the data simply isn't broadcast. But at Ben Gurion, you can't just turn off civilian transponder requirements because you'd blind the civilian ATC system to your military aircraft, which defeats the whole purpose of integrating.
What was the response to that incident?
According to the leaked CENT-COM data that Haaretz published on April 28th, the U Air Force instituted a new procedure within 48 hours requiring all military flights operating through Ben-Gurion to squawk a dedicated military code and coordinate through the embedded liaison officer rather than the civilian tower directly. It added about 7 minutes to each movement, but it closed the OPSEC gap.
7 minutes per movement during a conflict is not nothing.
It's not, and that's the trade-off. Every layer of security and segregation you add degrades the operational efficiency that made the dual-use airfield attractive in the first place.
Let's get into the resource sharing question, because the prompt specifically asked about that. What's actually shared between the military and civilian sides?
Runways are shared. Taxiways are shared. The fuel farm is shared. That's the massive underground fuel storage and distribution system that feeds the hydrant pits at every gate and apron position. The firefighting and rescue services are shared, though during the conflict, the IAF supplemented them with additional crash response vehicles positioned near the military apron.
The physical infrastructure is largely shared, but the operational control is not.
And the sharing is governed by strict priority protocols. During the Iran conflict, the IAF imposed what they called a military priority window from 0200 to 0500 local time. During those 3 hours, all civilian departures were halted entirely. The runways were reserved exclusively for U and Israeli military traffic.
Which is the middle of the night, so the disruption to civilian schedules is minimized, but not eliminated.
Not at all. The Israel Airports Authority released data on May 5th showing a 23% increase in civilian flight delays over the 2-week period of the conflict. That's nearly a quarter more delays than normal. Some of that was the military priority window, some was airspace closures, some was the general disruption of operating in a conflict zone, but a significant chunk was directly attributable to the military use of the airfield.
Passengers probably had no idea why their flight was delayed.
Most wouldn't. The NOTAMs, Notices to Airmen, did reference military operations, but the average passenger doesn't read NOTAMs. They just see a delay on the departure board and assume it's the airline's fault.
You've got a civilian airport that's handling 40% of all EU military airlift into the country during an active conflict, and the civilian passengers are experiencing a 23% delay increase, and most of them don't know the two things are connected.
That's the dual-use airfield in practice. And the 40% figure is significant. That's from the same leaked CENTCOM data. 40% of EU military airlift went through Ben-Gurion, 35% through Nevatim, and 25% through Ramon. Ben-Gurion was the single largest entry point for American military cargo into Israel during the conflict.
Which makes you wonder, if Ben-Gurion handled the most cargo, and it's a civilian airport, was that because the military airfields couldn't handle the volume?
Partly volume, partly capability. Nevatim's shorter runway means weight restrictions on fully loaded cargo aircraft, especially in hot weather when air density reduces lift. Ramon is farther from Tel Aviv's logistics infrastructure, so cargo has to be trucked further. Ben-Gurion is 20 minutes from the port of Ashdod and the major highways that connect to the northern front. It's simply better located.
The dual-use airfield isn't just a compromise. It's actually the optimal solution from a logistics perspective. And the risks are the price of that optimization.
That's exactly the tension. And it's not unique to Israel. Frankfurt Airport has a dedicated U Air Force ramp that's a legacy of the old Rhein-Main airbase. It uses a completely separate ATC frequency for military traffic, but it shares the same runways as Lufthansa 747s. Dubai World Central is designed from the ground up as a dual-use facility. Singapore's Changi has military dispersal areas built into its design.
Ben-Gurion isn't unusual in having dual-use capability. It's unusual in using it at scale during an active shooting war.
Most dual-use airfields operate in peacetime with occasional military movements, troop rotations, humanitarian flights, that sort of thing. What happened in April was qualitatively different. This was a combat logistics operation running through a civilian terminal that was still processing El Al flights to Newark and Wizz Air flights to Budapest.
The passengers on those flights were probably oblivious.
Unless they looked out the window at the right moment and saw a C-17 being loaded with ammunition pallets 200 meters away.
Which is a strange thing to see from C-22A.
It would certainly change the in-flight magazine browsing experience.
Let's talk about the comparisons, because this isn't the first time the EU military has run operations through civilian airports in a conflict zone.
The two obvious comparisons are Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul during the 2021 evacuation and Kuwait International Airport during the 2003 Iraq invasion. In both cases, you had civilian infrastructure pressed into military service at massive scale.
In both cases, it was chaotic.
Kabul was the extreme end of the spectrum. The military and civilian sides completely collapsed into each other. You had thousands of civilians on the runway, military aircraft taking off and landing in the middle of crowds, ATC effectively non-functional for a period. It was a worst-case scenario for dual-use operations, not because of the concept, but because the segregation failed entirely.
Kuwait in 2003?
Kuwait was more structured. Military took over entire terminals and converted them to logistics hubs. Civilian operations were suspended almost entirely. It was dual-use in name only. In practice, it became a military airfield with a civilian terminal attached that wasn't being used by civilians.
Ben-Gurion is unusual because it maintained genuine dual use throughout the conflict. Civilian flights kept operating. Passengers kept flowing through the terminal. The segregation held.
That's what makes it an interesting case study. It wasn't a collapse into military-only use, and it wasn't a peacetime exercise. It was a genuine test of whether the dual-use model can function under combat conditions.
The OPSEE incidents suggest the answer is mostly, but with significant vulnerabilities.
Those vulnerabilities aren't just technical. They're legal, they're operational, they're reputational. Every time a military aircraft squawks the wrong code or a cargo truck drives past the terminal, you're one OSINT post away from an international incident.
Given all these risks, you might wonder why any country would do this. The answer is capability, and that leads to some practical lessons.
The first takeaway here is that dual-use airfields are not going away. They're a feature of modern force projection, especially in regions with limited infrastructure. Israel has only a handful of air bases that can handle heavy cargo aircraft, and two of the three best ones were targeted by Iranian missiles. Ben-Gurion wasn't just convenient, it was necessary.
If you're designing a dual-use airfield from scratch, the key is building segregation into the architecture from day one. Separate aprons with physical barriers, separate ATC frequencies with a joint coordination cell, separate security perimeters that don't share access points. Retrofitting all of that onto an existing airport is vastly more expensive and less effective.
Frankfurt is the model here. Air Force Ramp at Frankfurt is effectively a self-contained military base that happens to share runways with the civilian airport. The taxiways connect, but the security perimeters don't overlap. The ATC frequencies are completely separate. The fuel systems are separate. It's about as segregated as you can get while still being on the same piece of concrete.
For aviation professionals listening to this, if you work at or near a dual-use airfield, you need to understand the ATC deconfliction protocols. Not just in theory, but the actual procedures that kick in when the military priority window opens. You need to know who the military liaison officer is and how to reach them. And you need to understand the legal framework, your country's rules of engagement, and its obligations under international humanitarian law. The line between military necessity and unlawful use of civilian infrastructure is thinner than most people realize.
It's not just controllers, ramp operators, fuelers, cargo handlers. Anyone who might interact with military movements needs to know what they're allowed to do and what they're absolutely not allowed to do. The April 14th OPSCEC incident wasn't an ATC failure. It was a flight crew configuration error. But it became an intelligence disaster because the civilian infrastructure broadcast it to the world.
For travelers, there's a practical takeaway here, too. During conflicts, check the NOTAMs for military priority windows and airspace restrictions. If you're flying out of a dual-use airfield in a conflict zone and your flight is delayed by 3 hours in the middle of the night, that's probably not airline incompetence. It's probably a deliberate operational decision to reserve the runway for military traffic. Your delay is a feature of the system, not a bug.
Understanding that doesn't make the delay less annoying, but it does make it less mysterious. There's a difference between the airline messed up and the U Air Force needed the runway for a C-17 carrying Patriot missiles. One of those is a customer service failure. The other is national defense.
The second one also makes for a better story at the baggage carousel.
It does, though I'd recommend against speculating about missile components in the baggage claim area.
That's probably good advice in general.
The broader point is that the transparency mechanisms exist if you know where to look. NOTAMs are public. ADS-B data is public, at least for civilian traffic. The Israel Airports Authority publishes delay statistics. You can piece together a remarkably detailed picture of what's happening at a dual-use airfield if you know how to read the data.
Which, ironically, is also the OPSEC problem. The transparency that helps passengers understand their delays is the same transparency that lets OSINT trackers identify Patriot missile shipments in 12 minutes.
That's the fundamental tension of the dual-use model. You can't have civilian transparency and military secrecy on the same airfield without one of them breaking. And in April, the secrecy broke.
Where does this go from here? The ICRC is drafting new guidance on dual-use infrastructure in urban warfare, expected late this year. That could change the legal calculus significantly.
And it's not just about Israel. South Korea has multiple dual-use airfields that would be critical in any conflict on the peninsula. The UAE has designed its new airports with military capability built in. Taiwan's airports are all effectively dual-use by necessity. Whatever the ICRC says will have ripple effects across multiple potential conflict zones.
There's also the technological dimension. Drone warfare and hypersonic missiles are making fixed airfields more vulnerable in general. If an adversary can strike any airfield with precision, does the civilian presence at a dual-use airfield act as a deterrent, or does it just put more civilians in the crosshairs?
That's the open question, and I don't think anyone has a good answer yet. The deterrence argument assumes adversaries care about civilian casualties in a way that constrains their targeting. The historical record on that is mixed at best. Iran targeted Nevatim and Ramon with ballistic missiles during this conflict, military airfields, not Ben-Gurion. Whether that was a deliberate choice to avoid civilian casualties or just a reflection of their targeting priorities is unclear.
If it was deliberate, was it because of international law, or because hitting Ben-Gurion would have triggered a much more severe response?
Probably both, and probably neither in a way we can cleanly separate. That's the nature of these calculations. The legal framework, the operational necessity, the deterrent effect, the OPSEC risks, they all blur together in practice.
Which is exactly what makes dual-use airfields such a fascinating problem. There's no clean solution. Every choice is a trade-off.
That's why this April's operations at Ben-Gurion are going to be studied for a long time. It's a rare case where the trade-offs were tested under real combat conditions, with real consequences, and with enough data leakage that we can actually analyze what happened.
All right. I think we've earned this. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, it took the blood of roughly 200,000 horseshoe crabs, harvested primarily from the Azores, where a short-lived processing facility operated between 1912 and 1917, to produce a single liter of amebocyte lysate for detecting bacterial endotoxins. Modern recombinant factor C assays now produce the equivalent testing capacity from a fermentation vat the size of a household washing machine.
A vat the size of a washing machine versus 200,000 crabs.
The crabs won that round, I think. They're not the ones being fermented.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you have a weird prompt, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com, and if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with more questions you didn't know you needed answered.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.